Chapter 5. Governor welcomes surprise, should be happy to see Captain Gunram and Midshipman's berth at 4:30, called the signal midshipman to the First Lieutenant, who relayed the message to Captain Aubrey 3 feet from its source. Very kind in him, I'm sure, said Jack. Please reply, many thanks, accept with pleasure, surprise. No, scrub that. With greatest pleasure, surprise. You know the moorings as well as I do, Mr. Harding. Carry on, if you please, bearing the surf and our number one uniforms in mind. The captain and the officers of the frigate had done pretty well, even very, very well, out of their Barbary prize. But from the depths of their beings rose an anxious care for the outward marks of their rank. Insignificant in comparison with those of their fellows in the army, often well-to-do, but of the first importance to a sailor, living or attempting to live on his pay. Another fact that tempered their delight in the invitation was the Royal Navy's custom of feeding its midshipmen, as much as it fed them at all, apart from their private stock, stores and family pots of jam, at noon, the officers rather later, and the captain whenever he chose, usually at about 1 or 1:30. So, as usual, in response to an official land-borne invitation, the surprises approached Government House, groomed to the highest state of cleanliness and polish, but slavering with greed or with appetites wholly extinguished. Yet, at least this time, their precious uniforms, thanks to a little new jetty or pier, were still immaculate. And as soon as they'd been properly introduced to Sir Henry, given their glass of sherry and seated, the officers with a female partner and the midshipmen promiscuously, their spirits began to revive. Jack's partner was, of course, Lady Morris. Stevens, apparently without any regard for his humble service rank, was Christine Wood. This was obviously the result of a deliberate manoeuvre on Lady Morris's part. She said something about common interest in birds, as Christine made her curtsy and Stephen his bow, and was sure that dear Mr. Harding would forgive her when she introduced him to the ADC's ravishing young wife, would forgive her on the grounds of a previous acquaintance in spite of his seniority. Previous acquaintance or not, they were painfully embarrassed, tongue-tied and awkward as they sat there, crumbling bread and responding to the usual civilities from their other neighbours. It was only when a plantain-eater uttered its horrible screech that Stephen cried, "Surely it's too far north for that creature." And she replied almost sharply that in spite of Hudson, Dumesnil and others, Sierra Leone was by no means the northern limit of the plantain-eaters. Two pairs had bred in her garden this year, and there were reports of others well beyond the river even. This re-established them on their former basis of scientific candour, and he told her of his anomalous nuthatch in the Atlas, of the numerous bodies of lions that would gather to roar at one another from either side of a river in those parts, of the extraordinary wealth of flamingos. Presently, their earlier friendship, affection, and more than affection, flowed back like a making tide on an open strand, flowed imperceptibly but without the least question. Like civilized creatures, they paid proper attention to their other neighbours, but to the observant part of the company in general, their particularity was so evident that a Mrs. Wilson, whose daughter was on Stephen's left, was heard to say, "Really, the gentleman seems quite besotted with that Mrs. Wood." Her friends replied that a rich widow would naturally seem very desirable to a penniless naval surgeon. When they parted, he said, "I am so very glad to have seen you again. I am a most indifferent writer, and I am only too painfully aware that my answers to your dear letters, to one above all, have been painfully inadequate. May I presume to call upon you tomorrow? I long to see your latest remarks on Adamson. And then again, there is all the northern shore of the marsh that we had to leave unexplored. Did you in the end fix our Porphyria as a breeding species?" "I should be very happy to see you," she said a little nervously. "Shall we say at about 10, if your duty allows? You know where I live, I presume?"
"I do not."
"It's the rather brutal square building below Government House. perhaps half a mile to the north, almost at the edge of the water. I bought it myself as a holiday place, in no way official, and, as I said, near the shore. I shall send Jenny in case you should miss the way. Well before 10, Jenny came alongside in a skiff expertly rowed by Square, a beaming crewman who had accompanied Stephen on his earlier visit, and who now hailed the ship with such pleasure that all who heard him smiled. "Dear Square, how happy I am to see you again," said Stephen, descending with his usual grace, saved at the last minute by a powerful hand.
"The lady said I was to see you safe aboard. Oh, mind them tholepins!"
Square seized him again, and somehow balancing the frail craft while Jenny slid forward, set him down in the stern.
"Easy does it, Square," called Jack, voicing the anxiety of all aboard. And, in fact, easy did it.
In time, they saw Dr. Maturin creep up the few remaining steps of a solid, unmoving ladder. The tide was almost full, and walk firmly away into the town. "What possessed me not to lay on my own barge, I cannot imagine," said Jack to his first lieutenant, who shook his head, unable to offer any comfort.
"Should you like a hammock, sir?"
asked Square, meaning one of those drooping cushioned nets extended by poles in a yoke, which served as sedan chairs or hackney coaches in Freetown.
"I'd as soon walk," said Stephen. "But let's skirt the marketplace, and perhaps Jenny will buy us each a length of sugar cane."
This they did, gazing over the great crowded, immensely vociferous square on the right hand, piled with glorious fruit, fish slabs with half the wealth of the Atlantic, decently shrouded booths beyond holding dark, nameless flesh, while away on the left, spotted with disconsolate camels and asses, an anonymous pasture stretched beyond the walls right down to the water's edge. Varying waters, salt, fresh and semi-liquid mud among the mangroves, with the brutal square building in its garden a great way off but quite distinct. At the first heap of sugar cane, Stephen gave Jenny a small silver piece, and they turned off to the left, threading their way down through as surprising a mixture of African and European nations as can well be imagined, with a plentiful sprinkling of Arabs and Moors and Syrians and crosses of almost every shade, including some with naturally rather than hennaed red hair. But as soon as they were clear of the town, the easy downward slope had almost no one on it. And Stephen walked with his gaze well above the horizon, indeed halfway up the sky. For already the rising currents of air had carried many a soaring bird aloft. He was intent upon one of them. A vulture, of course. But what vulture? Griffin? Lappet-faced? Hooded? Possibly Repel's griffin? The light, though strong, was awkwardly placed for the distinguishing marks of a very high bird planing on the southwest breeze.
"Sir,"
said Square, stopping on the edge of a small freshwater stream that ran down from the right. And following the pointed finger, Stephen saw an exactly defined print in the mud. A leopard's left forepaw, perfect even to the slight claw mark, and strikingly recent.
"They come for dogs," said Jenny.
It was perfectly true, but neither of the men thought it in her place to say so. And the word spots died in her mouth.
"This is much more promising,"
observed Stephen, his small telescope having shown him the surface of the bay dotted with waterfowl and perhaps some few waders far over. The minute ping of his watch, it could hardly be called a chime, interrupted his close examination of the flamingos, and he said, "Come, Square, come, Jenny, we must not be late." In through a massive gate to a stable yard, with an assembly of bristling, suspicious dogs, kept in order only by Jenny's presence and firm admonition, and so round to the front where Mrs. Wood had just finished thrusting her puttied legs into riding boots.
"Oh," cried she, "I do beg pardon for not having come out to meet you. We had a roaring, bellowing night of it with that damn leopard, and the dogs are still very cross. What she hopes to gain by it, I cannot imagine. Should you like some canvas-top boots? I can almost promise a tolerable bird if we go almost at once, but we should have to paddle, or even wade a little by the mangrove, and the leeches are such a nuisance. She sounded so very like her brother Edward when she said this that Stephen replied, "Dear Miss Christine, how kind you are. I truly detest a leech." But collecting himself as she laced the sailcloth tops, he went on, "Forgive my familiarity, I beg. That is what Edward and I used to call you." "And he called you Stephen, as I did when speaking of you to him. So, if I may, I shall go on. It comes so naturally." Perfectly naturally by the time they reached the water and she was explaining its very curious nature. "Now, look, Stephen, beyond the pygmy geese, but before the flamingos, Christine, can you make out whether the nearer bird is a greater flamingo or the slightly smaller kind?" "A lesser, I do believe. But we shall see better when we're a little farther round and he brings his head up, showing his bill more clearly. Well, between the pygmy geese and those sparse, dubious flamingos, there's a sandbank that'll show in an hour or so. The water on the far side is brackish and on our side fresh. Well, fairly fresh, except at huge, great high tides. But if you look along the shore to the right, you'll see a fair-sized freshwater stream coming down through the tall reeds. Beyond that, a dark bank of mangroves with their feet in the brackish mud, because there, the sandbank curls into the shore. Then, farther on, now you can hardly see it from here, except for the trees growing on its banks, another stream, a small river, indeed, where Jenny and I go and swim." Stephen nodded. "And there's an inlet beyond its mouth where I hope to show you a splendid bird. Oh, and thank you very much for the hermaphrodite crab. There's something like him or her in that small bay. Shall we sit down on the bank here? This dear little northerly breeze keeps the mosquitoes off. And look at the birds. If there are any uncommon stragglers, we may be able to make them out between us, or at least take notes." There was indeed a splendid wealth of birds on the water, including some very, very old friends such as widgeon, tufted duck, mallard and shoveler, perfectly at home among the neat little pygmy geese, knob-billed and spur-winged geese, white-faced tree duck and the odd unhingos, to say nothing of the blue-breasted kingfisher that darted overhead and the steady patrol of vultures in the upper sky. "Shall we go on?" asked Christine at last. "You don't dislike mangroves?" "Not at all," he replied. "I cannot say that I should ever deliberately cultivate one, but I'm accustomed to their presence, have crept some miles among them and their loathsome flies further down the coast. These are only a sickly little patch. They have too much sweet water and they cannot thrive. Yet at least it is oh so much quicker and less painful than struggling through those cruel thorns higher up the slope behind them. I find the best way is to cling to the aerial roots as well as anything else that comes to hand. Undignified, if you like, but better than falling plump into that vile, stinking black mud. And we must get along fairly quick. He begins to move when the sun is about this height." Stephen understood that he was some particular creature, bird, reptile, possibly mammal, of a rarity that would delight him. He asked no questions, and soon he had no time to ask any that might arise, as he concentrated on following her practiced steps through this slimy shade. Yet most unhappily, as both sun and tide mounted, Christine moved faster, just too fast for her mud-clogged boots. The aerial roots' pale wands hanging plumb straight down from the upper tree betrayed her, and she did indeed fall plump into that vile black stinking mud, angering the small fishes that skipped on its surface, the many kinds of crab, and the little mud tortoises that preyed on both. Stephen lurched forward to heave her out, met with the same fate, and they wallowed painfully slowly on all fours to the extreme edge of the mangrove trees, where clean water and a fairly clean bottom allowed them to crawl ashore in a very distressing state of filth. She gasped, begged his pardon, and said, "Oh, I hope we didn't disturb him." "Probably not. There's 200 yards to go. Does nakedness worry you?" "Not in the least. After all, we're both anatomists."
Very well, said she, there's nothing for it. We must both strip and rid our clothes of mud and our bodies of leeches. We have clean water here, thanks be, and in my pocket the salt for the leeches in a corked bottle. May I give you a hand with your boots? She did so. He did the same for her, and they stripped off their clothes without the least ceremony, floating the mud out of them, weighing them down with stones, and then they attended to the astonishingly numerous and avid leeches, each dealing with the other's back in a wholly impersonal manner. Apart from some artists' models and nations that possessed no clothes at all, Stephen had never seen anyone so unconcerned with nudity. And on reflection, he remembered her brother Edward, his intimate friend, telling him that he and she had bathed, naturalised and fished, wearing nothing at all, from small childhood to maturity, in the isolated lake that formed part of their family's park. Well before this, during his first visit, she and her black companion had wandered into his field of vision as he searched the farther shore of a mere for birds, and he admired not only their freedom, but also the combination of green, black, white, and the whiter-than-white of an egret. Yet, as objectively as he watched duck and cormorants. But now, a tall, graceful, willowy shape was emphasised by the thin vermilion streams that flowed from the leech bites. It didn't coagulate, the creatures injecting a substance that thinned the blood, turned it a fine vermilion, and allowed them a much longer period of feeding. And these outlined the curve of her long, long legs with an extraordinary pleasing effect. And now something of the scientist, something of the pure anatomist, began to leave him. Presently the flies will grow intolerable, she said. It'd be better to put on damp clothes than to have them crawling about all over one. Still, she did spread some of the wettest on sun-warmed rocks. They dried quite soon. But even sooner, the mounting sun made her uneasy. They put the garments on as well as they could, and she led the way, murmuring, "Oh, that he may not have gone." She reached a last screen of rushes before a small, secluded inlet, and as she did so, there leapt into the air a perfectly enormous bird of the heron kind, bluish on top, chestnut below, with immense green legs and a deep, furious, baying cry. He filled the narrow space of sky before vanishing seawards, leaving Stephen perfectly amazed. He kissed Christine quite ardently, thanking her with the most profound gratitude. She blushed and said, "Oh, how glad I am we hadn't flushed him. He's as touchy as a Roman emperor." "Lord," said Stephen, "that such a bird can fly, can take to the air." When he'd recovered from his amazement, which was not soon, and when their clothes were moderately dry, he observed with pleasure that in spite of the fact that they'd stalked about together stark naked, she had a certain coquetry in arranging the fall of her principal garment. "Now, should you like to go to the house and have tea, and then come down to the hides out there?" Nodding to some reed shelters on or just off the true shore, "so that when the sun is gone, I hope to be able to show you a most prodigious wonder. You don't have to go back to the ship directly, I trust?" "Oh, no. If there is any urgency aboard, they'll send for me, but with my colleague already there, it's scarcely possible." "To tea, then. And at least we have a Christian path to the house. Coming down it again, we should be wise to carry a gun. The poor leopard is growing desperate, I fear. So many insatiable cubs. Have you ever seen them?" "Yes. She keeps them in a tumble of rocks on the hillside, and if you climb an oil palm about 200 yards along, you can see them peeping out just after dawn, waiting for her. I drove 10-penny nails into the trunk, and many a good skirt have they cost me when I slip." "Jenny," she called, walking into the house with a little cloud of dogs, "tell Ngombe that we should like tea, and pray run and fetch a really cool cucumber for sandwiches. Stephen," she went on, "should you like a dressing gown?" "No, thank you, my dear. I've walked myself dry." Then forgive me for a moment while I put something decent on my back. There were some bird skins on her work table with the heaps of notes required for an intelligent commentary on Adamson, and he looked at them with an interest quite devoid of prying, at the same time revolving one of those curious problems of limit. You may kill a leopard if she assumes a threatening attitude, thus condemning her beautiful cubs to a hideous and lingering death. You may shoot and skin a number of slightly differing green pigeons and wood doves, with no more of a tremor than Sir Joseph Blaine impaling a butterfly. Yet, to the question, you wouldn't destroy the whole litter and be shot of them, you may reply, if you had seen a little leopard, I don't think you would ask. The door opened. Why, my dear, how very fine you look now you're cleaned and brushed. Pray, what is this skin? Clearly a pigeon, but I cannot make out which. He's Gamelin's Triranthome from the island down in the gulf. Here comes the tea. What joy. There's nothing like tea for getting rid of the taste of mangrove mud. It was brought with proper ceremony by an immense, grave, very black man, and almost immediately after it was followed by the cucumber sandwiches and some little round affairs, not unlike marzipan. They made a good, serious tea, passing birdskins from hand to hand and speaking of their infant greed. Muffins, crumpets, buttered toast with anchovy relish, deeply iced fruitcake, in the most companionable way. But towards the end, Stephen noticed that she was looking out of the window with something of the anxiety of one who doesn't wish to miss the evening rise. He refused another cup, and rose briskly at her suggestion that they should go down to the hides. Lanterns would bring them up again so they could stay as long as they chose. "I shall entrust the gun to you, if I may," she said, rather as though it were an umbrella, and led the way out with a fine, elastic step, putting her boots on again in the hall. Down, with plenty of light and a three-quarter moon rising over Africa. Stephen said, "Sometimes, you know, I'm shockingly careless of the common decencies of life." "You mean taking all our clothes off in that abandoned way?" "Dear me, no, our forebears did that long before us. Long before they had any notion of that apron of fig leaves. No, what grieves me is my never uttering a single word. Not the least inquiry after your chanting goshawks, begging you to tell me how they do." "Alas, Stephen, alas. A battleur killed their mother and I didn't succeed in bringing them up. You've seen a battleur, I make no doubt."
"I have too.
The most remarkable of the eagles, if he is an eagle at all, which some naturalists deny. She was out in the yard on her perch, and he came down with a noise like a stooping peregrine, but twice as loud, chased her into the stable and instantly killed her. Hassan took her body away, netted the eagle, and so left him in the dark. He was, and is, a young bird, and terribly fierce at the slightest threat. But quite soon we were on reasonably good terms. He's surprisingly intelligent and even kind. Indeed, very good terms. I turned him free, and even now, for this is his territory, he'll come racing down onto my shoulder to ask how I do. How I hope I may see him. He at least is a bird one can never mistake. No tail, no tail at all. You would say a scythe, flying at enormous speed. Wonderful gyrations. Tell me, what about bats? I must confess that I've not paid as much attention to bats as I should have done. There are such myriads of birds. One of them, by the way, lives on bats, together with the odd evening pipit. He's a buzzard, really, of moderate size, but extraordinary agility, as you may imagine. They eat their bats straight out of their talons in the air. I only know two couples. Here we are. And here is really quite a good path, and then a little sort of causeway to the main... Well, you can hardly call it a building, but the place or hide from which my husband and his guests used to shoot the flighting duck and the smaller geese. You can stand there seeing and not being seen. A capital place if you like to watch the waders and many, many of the little things in the reeds. Take care on the causeway. Here's the rope. Inside it was surprisingly light. Their eyes were already accustomed to the afterglow. It was no more. And they could make out geese and duck by the hundred. "But, my dear Stephen," she said, gently turning him round to the shore and the trees, "this is the way you must look. And, oh, how I hope my 9 days' wonder remembers the appointment. We're rich in nightjars, as you know. Do you hear the one over to the east?"
"A dear bird.
Our homely European kind, is he not?" "Certainly. But I meant the deeper croak to the left." He listened, caught the sound, and said, "It's a nightjar of a sort, to be sure, the family voice." The bird stopped. They stood poised, listening. Then suddenly she touched his arm. "There's my bird," she whispered. "Oh, how I hope he comes." Stephen caught the shrill, lasting chirr, and as a waft of air brought the sound closer, it soon dropped in pitch, growing much more present. "Don't move," she murmured. They stood taut, their senses at the stretch, the utmost stretch, and clear against the pale sky, not 20 yards before them, flew a bird with a nightjar's action, but extraordinarily modified by two immensely elongated flight feathers on either side, trailing far behind, more than doubling its length. With an instant change of direction, it swooped on a pale moth, captured it, and flew off, lost against the darkness of the trees. She'd been gripping his arm. Now she released it, saying, "He did come. Oh, I'm so glad. You saw him clear, Stephen. Clear. Perfectly clear. And I am amazed. Amazed. Thank you very much indeed for showing him to me, dear Christine. Lord, such wealth. Such an acquisition. Will you tell me about him?" "Well, very little I know. He shores Caprimulgus longipennis, and he's uncommon in these parts, above all in his full mating plumage. I've seen only two all the time I've been here. That perfectly astonishing train, by the way, is just the 9th primary on either side. And how the poor bird manages to get into the air, I cannot imagine, above all if he happens to be on the ground. We have another nightjar with enormously exaggerated flight feathers, Macrodipteryx vexillarius, but his are only pointed, not bushy at the tips like ours. But in any case, I've never been able to make really valuable observations of either, nor of their plain long-tailed cousin. I shouldn't have missed that for anything. On the face of it, those primaries destroy the bird's efficiency, just as the peacock's ludicrous train or the lavish display of the birds of paradise may be presumed to cost them a very great deal, yet they live and even thrive. Could it be that our notions, or at least my notions, are fundamentally mistaken? There he is again. And another, the ordinary long-tailed bird. They stood in silence, slowly relaxing. "There's our Scops owl," said she. Some duck passed over, widgeoned by the sound of their wings, and broke the surface 100 yards away with a surprising noise in this dead-still night. "Stephen," she said after a while, "I'm afraid you're uneasy. Shall I go away for a few minutes? You can whistle when you want me back." "No, soul," he said. "This is really not the usual physical matter, but rather a question of throwing my petition into a reasonably acceptable form. In short, it would give me infinite joy if you would marry me. Yet before you instantly put me to silence, let me at least say what I can in my own favour. Admittedly, I am very far from being even tolerably good-looking, but from the physician's point of view, I'm pretty sound, with no grossly evident vices. Materially, I believe I may say that I am what is ordinarily called well-to-do, with an ancient house and a reasonable estate in Spain. I could without difficulty buy a decent place or set of chambers in London or Dublin, or Paris, for that matter. I stand reasonably well in my profession and in the service. My worst enemies couldn't truthfully say that I was a loose liver addicted to gaming or the bottle. And although in candour I cannot deny that my birth was illegitimate and my church that of Rome, I do not like to think that to a person of your distinguished intelligence these are total bars to a union, above all since I should make no claims of any kind. Finally, I should like to add that, as you are aware, I am a widower. Your letter touched me to the heart, and that I have a daughter. After a while, during which at least three separate nightjars chirred and one owl called, she said, "Stephen, you do me infinite honour, and it grieves me more than I can say to desire you to dismiss the subject from your mind. I have been married, as of course you know, and very unhappily married. I too am pretty sound from the physician's point of view. I too am reasonably wealthy, but I'm speaking, of course, to an honourable man. My husband was incapable of the physical aspects of marriage, and his vain attempts to overcome this defect gave me what I have believed to be an ineradicable disgust for everything to do with that aspect. The whole seemed to me a violent and, of course, inept desire for possession and physical dominance. And this impression was no doubt reinforced by my own fear and reluctance." And speaking in an entirely different tone, after a period of silence, she said, "In your experience as a physician, would you say that this was a usual state of mind in a young married woman?" He reflected and said, "I have very rarely encountered a case in which the circumstances were so extreme as yours. But I do know how often the sorrow and woe that is in marriage arise from want of elementary physical understanding, to say nothing of ineptitude, selfishness, gross ignorance, and a kind of hostility, resentment." "Agreed, agreed. Please wipe my foolish, self-seeking words from your memory as far as ever you can. But do let's go on exchanging notes on Addison. There are the lanterns coming down through the trees." "Oh, dear," she said, taking his hand, "I'm afraid I wounded you. A man I esteem more than any who have ever addressed me. Stephen, I'm so sorry." The eastern nightjar had begun its song again, its chirr, apparently without ever drawing breath. And by way of distracting his mind from the sorrow, Stephen counted the pulse of his heart. It reached 75 before the birds stopped. The lights were on the edge of the wood, and he was aware that Christine had been weeping. On the way up, she took his arm, and in the house they sat down to a curiously delicious supper based on African vegetables that he didn't know, and eggs, with a tolerable white wine. Then came the almond pudding, followed by a capital Madeira. Pushing the plates aside, she showed him the astonishing skin of Caprimulgus longipennis and told him about the power of those particular feathers as juju in local belief. "The longer I live in Africa," she observed when they were drinking the wretched coffee and some excellent rum, "and the more I know about Africans, the nearer I come to a sort of diffused pantheism." Reverting to this a little later, when her spirits had revived somewhat, she said, "I know my divinity angers missionaries to a quite surprising degree, and upon the whole I don't care for them either, not very much. But sometimes a missionary is also a naturalist. And if he's far away in the bush, he may have wonderful opportunities. I'm sure you've heard of the Congo peacock." "Indeed, I've often heard tell of him, but I've never known him described by a credible witness." "Well," she said, feeling in a drawer, "I don't say that this is proof positive," holding out a green feather, "but it was given me by a very old Franciscan, I think a Catholic in any event, who died here before he could take ship, and who told me without the least pomp or showing away that he'd plucked it from the back of a recently dead peacock in the Congo. I forget the name of the district, but the bird lived in open woodland." "Dear me, Christine," he said, caressing the feather, "you've amazed and delighted me three times today. the elephantine heron, the wildly eccentric more-than-improbable nightjar, and now the fabled Congo peacock, on whose existence I shall now pledge my soul. I am sorry that you don't choose to marry me, but I thoroughly understand your, what shall I say, disinclination. A surprising length of time, of emotional time, had passed between their standing in the hide, the space of his declaration, and the present with its entirely different context. She smiled, drank a little more rum, patted his knee and said, "Tell me, Stephen, if I'd accepted your dear, dear proposal, how should you have managed the purely material side of the union? You've spoken of your daughter. How old is she?" "I'm ashamed to say I cannot tell. Quite young, sure, nowhere near puberty." "Then again, you're engaged with your friend on a distant and, I presume, important voyage?" "To be sure," said Stephen, looking wretchedly from side to side. "Yet I was not entirely thoughtless. Believe me," he said earnestly, "I was not entirely selfish. I had a very pretty solution. My idea was that you should go to England, there to stay with Sophie Aubrey, a charming woman and a very old friend, who has two girls and a son, who looks after Bridget, my daughter, and who lives in a large house in Dorset with quantities of friends all round, a most respectable body of servants. And then it appeared to what I can only diffidently call my mind, in other words, the embodiment of my wishes, that I should return from the sea, and that together we should plot the course of our days. England, Ireland, France, or Spain, or any combination, according to your choice." "Dear me, dear me," she said with a sigh. And hearing the minute voice of Stephen's watch, "Was there a clock somewhere? Can it be 12? He plucked it from his waistcoat. "Yes, 12 it is by the ship's exact noon observation of the sun." "Oh, what a pretty thing. Will it chime again?" It chimed again. And Stephen asked, "Do you like it?" "I think it's perfectly beautiful. Is it what they call a repeater?" "Yes, ma'am." "I've never seen one before." She was clearly fascinated. He put it back into her hand, showed her the buttons to be pressed, and said, "There, my dear. It's yours. A very slight acknowledgement of the delights you've given me today." "Oh, what nonsense, Stephen, dear," she said, repressing a smile. "Of course I can't possibly accept such a present, though I return 100,000 thanks for the intention." She put it gently on the table, stood up and said, "Come, it's already late. Let me show you to your room." It was a fine, large, airy place, and the window framed the declining moon. She drew the curtain and said, "I'm afraid you brought no night clothes, Stephen. Should you like one of my gowns?" "Lord, no, my dear. I'm perfectly happy to lie in my skin like Adam before the fall." "Well, good night, Stephen. There's water and a towel, there's soap. I do hope you'll sleep well." "Good night, my dear. I shall be up before the sun, since I mean to walk up and over to rejoin my ship, so please forgive me if I take my leave now." Long he lay on the flat of his back, head supported by both hands, and above all by his sense of the weakening of Christine's absolute resistance. He turned the events of a singularly varied day in his mind, and a great way off, 2, 3, and even 4 different nightjars chirred at their various pitches. In spite of their earlier farewell, Christine joined him for breakfast. "I'm so sorry I grieved you," she said, looking at him uneasily after the first civilities. "I had no notion of your far more grievous reasons," he replied. "It was deeply impercipient. But before I go, please let me say that, as I see it, marriage does not necessarily mean possession. Far, far less dominance."
Stephen, I wouldn't hurt you for the world. You're going on a long and, I hope, very fruitful voyage. May I turn the whole thing over in my mind while you're away? And with the blessing, I may come round. Come back to thinking and feeling like an ordinary woman. But, my dear, after a long, long pause, you're not to feel in the slightest degree bound. No, not the very least degree. Stephen bowed, and having poured him more coffee, she went on hesitantly, "Did you not say that the Aubreys lived in Dorsetshire? I'm going to cousins next month who live near Bridport, and if I can be of any use in carrying letters, either of you have but to command." "That would be wonderfully kind. I know that Captain Aubrey has a heap of paper written small, and I've not done badly. But tell me, though this is a personal question, which I detest, do you find it easy to travel?" "Lord, yes, I often go back. I may take Jenny, but I can perfectly well go alone. I find that men, particularly seamen, are particularly kind to women on their own. And a single trunk does very well. A big, roomy Portuguese guinea man touches here next month. She'll put me down at the pool, as usual, and the agents will carry me and my trunk to Grillon's, where I generally stay. And after a day or two of shopping, I shall take a postchaise down. It's as simple as that." "Of course. I'd always known of women travelling to and from India by themselves, but from some imbecility of mind, West Africa seemed infinitely more remote. If I may, I shall send up our packets directly, for tomorrow we shall sail." "Goodbye, dear Stephen," she said in the doorway. "Goodbye, dear Christine. God bless." He walked away from the house a little after sunrise with no more than a dissatisfied or inquisitive look from the dogs in the outer yard. A clear, cool morning, and a little flock of bulbuls flew over him as he sat down halfway up the hill to gaze out over the water. The duck were no longer moving, but the flamingos were busy, and he liked to think that behind the mangrove belt he could just make out the monstrous form of that improbable great heron Ardea Goliath. Rising, he climbed the hill, but with a rather languid step. Even a short time at sea made walking on the unyielding ground quite arduous for a while, but his heart glowed with sanguine hope. Yet for all his meditations on the possibility of a happy future, and his rehearsing of the wonders he'd seen the day before, his stomach kept up its peevish cry, above all at the scent of coffee wafting from the southern gate. Christine's servants, though devoted and so trustworthy that she could leave the house without a qualm, lacked one prime virtue. They could not make coffee. The household drank tea, and this morning's thin brownish wash, saved from yesterday, was a special concession to the guest, poor soul. Once he was inside the walls, he walked straight to a decent-looking place at the corner of the market square, called for a pot, and heard Jacob's voice saying, "Dear colleague, I wish you a very good morning indeed. May I join you?" Stephen replied that nothing would give him more pleasure. And after a few preliminaries, Jacob said, "If you were not my superior officer, I should venture to say that you push discretion much too far in not asking me what I'm doing, what I think I'm about, why I am here, and who is looking after our patients. But you are my superior officer, so without any comment I shall voluntarily tell you that two other men of war came in shortly after you left with Square and the girl. Their captains paid their duty calls early, and in the afternoon we began a three-sided competition, games of cricket, a boxing match, and races between the various boats. They intend doing the whole dreary thing over again today on an even larger scale, together with bouts of raising and lowering masts and sails and even of gunfire, for God's sake, all against a stopwatch. I cannot bear it. So I escaped at the earliest possible moment. I get in the way, I'm pushed and blamed and even cursed. And as for patients, we have no patients, no bedridden patients, all the sick having declared themselves whole. No patients other than a youth from the Erebus
whom your young friend Hansen struck to the ground with a murderous blow. It is only, in fact, a passing concussion, but his shipmates feign infinite concern and swear that if it prove fatal they will keel-haul the Lion of the Atlas, as they call our champion, with his own intestines. The zeal and animation which fills these three ships with the various exhibitions of maritime skill passes all understanding. Most of the officers are as deeply concerned as the men, but I must say that Captain Aubrey seems somewhat oppressed, and if he didn't have official business ashore, I think he might succumb. He poured more coffee, plucked off another 6 inches of soft bread, and looking attentively at his old friend, asked, "Stephen, are you satisfied with the captain's health?"
"His physical health?
Can the two be separated?"
"On occasion, yes. But to be sure, in general, the two are very intimately connected."
"His light seems to have gone out."
"His wife has used those very words."
"Whereas yours, if I may say so, Stephen, glows like a moderately resplendent sun. I hope, my dear, you do not dislike my speaking in this way." They had, as usual, lapsed back into the French of their youth. "But we have, after all, known one another a great many years."
"We have indeed, Amos."
"No, I don't dislike it at all in you. And I shall try to make the dimming, which I perfectly admit, more comprehensible. As far as the Royal Navy is concerned, I, for one, am attached, loosely attached, to the service. He is literally of it. And success or failure in the Navy is, and always has been, of paramount importance. He's risen high. He's a post-captain near the top of the list. But he is at that stage when some members of the group, with approximately the same seniority, are selected for flag rank as Rear Admiral of the Blue. By no means all can be chosen. Those who are not chosen, those who are passed over, are colloquially or by way of derision known as yellow admirals, admirals of a non-existent squadron. And that is the end of the poor man's hopes. There is no return to eligibility. Merit has something to do with this vital step, yet influence has more. Political and family influence have more, sometimes much more, and Jack Aubrey has not always been politically wise. He's very much afraid of picking up the Gazette in the next few months and of seeing men junior to himself being given their flag. A blue flag to be hoisted at the mizzen, if my memory serves. A piece of bunting extraordinarily important to a man who has pursued it with such ardour for so many years. And now that we are no longer at war, now that there is virtually no chance of his distinguishing himself, it's understandable that his light should at least grow dim. There is the real possibility that it should go out entirely. And there's nothing that can restore it, nothing but that piece of cloth. Nothing. A pause, and he went on. The malady, the state of mind, is called flag sickness in the Navy. And it affects almost all ambitious post-captains as they approach the decisive period. I've rarely seen it close at hand since all my service has been under one commander, but I've often spoken of it to my colleagues, and they agree in saying that those affected, that is to say all but the few officers whose achievements, family connections or immediate political influence make their promotion sure, suffer from anxiety, loss of appetite and joie de vivre, while often the essentially masculine functions are disturbed, so that medical men have observed either a virtual impotence or an unwholesome activity. Here there is nothing so extreme, but there is an oppression. Little or no music, and he will play chess, cards or backgammon only out of complacence. They returned to their coffee and sat considering for a while. Then Stephen said, "Amos, at one time there were several Syrians and Armenians here, men of business, agents. Do you know any at present? It's of no vital importance, but I should like to know about a large Portuguese Guinea man bound for England, a vessel in which a lady, a friend of mine, is to take passage."
Dear me, yes, said Amos, amused. Is not my own cousin Lloyd's representative in this port? Shall I take you to him? Stephen felt for his watch. No watch, of course, but a jet of delight. And a church clock told him that it was 9. You're very good, but would he or one of his clerks undertake so small a commission? I only wish to fill her cabin with flowers, or rather to have it so filled. And since we sail tomorrow and the guinea man doesn't touch here for a great while, clearly the flowers must be procured by proxy. I'm quite certain that he would be delighted. Another pot? Thank you, but I believe I should go down as soon as we've seen your amiable cousin. I shall come with you, if I may. Your seniority, your austere countenance, may be something of a protection against rude mirth, and in any case this morning they mean to renew their pugilism, so we may have serious casualties to attend to. The two medicos, their errand happily accomplished, set off from the mole during a lull in the roaring aboard surprise, the calls of "Break him and tear him, mate!" and the dull sound of impassioned blows given and received. Some of their friends gave them a hand up the side. "Thank you, Mr. Hanson," said Stephen safely on deck. But he went on looking at the youth. "I'm afraid you've been in the wars." Certainly he had one eye thoroughly blacked, and there was dried blood on his lower face, while one ear was visibly swelling. "Oh, sir," replied Hanson, with a cheerful and full-toothed smile, "it was only a little sparring. Still, you'd better come below and let me put a stitch or two in that eyebrow." Sitting there on a stool while the needle was preparing, Hanson explained that his adversary, a master's mate from Hector, though heavy and a thoroughly game chicken, had no notion of the long straight left to the throat. Not to the point, sir, but to the throat. Nothing settled your cove quicker than a determined blow to the throat. "I should think not, indeed," said Stephen. "Now, pray, lean over and don't start away at the prick. There. Well done. Are you to fight again?" "Not until after dinner, sir. And he's said not to be truly wicked. Yet even so, should he aim a blow at your head, you would be well advised to avert this eyebrow and face him crabwise. Now I must go and see the captain. In the cabin, I presume?" "Yes, sir. And thank you very much for your care of me." Captain Aubrey was indeed in the cabin, leaning over some bundles of official papers tied with black tape or red. "There you are," he cried, raising his head with a smile. And having looked attentively at Stephen's face, he went on, "I do hope you've had some really prodigious good news." "I have too," said Stephen, not quite so prodigious as I could have wished, since the lady not surprisingly declined my proposal. "But she did say she would consider it while we were away. And she did offer to carry our letters back to England. She's going to visit cousins near Bridport, so may I beg you, dear Jack, to write to Sophie, urging her to invite Mrs. Wood? I should very much like her to become well acquainted not only with Sophie and her children, but also with my Bridget. It would give me the utmost pleasure if they were to love one another." "There's no reason why they shouldn't. I'm quite sure that Sophie, bless her, and Mrs. Wood couldn't fail to get along famously, while Bridget is a dear, affectionate little creature, and she's grateful for quite a little kindness and attention. My girls, being older, don't regard her as much as they should. I've often thought of mentioning it. But, as Sophie says, rating has never yet begot tenderness, and they tend to be somewhat jealous. It's delicate ground to venture on. A stranger can sometimes do more than either parent. I've no doubt that Bridget and Mrs. Wood will be friends. After all, I do know Mrs. Wood quite well, and I esteem her immensely. Admire her too, if I may say so. Should Sophie ask her to stay until we come back? We've quantities of room now that Clarissa's married and gone. That would be more than kind. But she also means to go up to Northumberland to see her brother Edward, my particular friend, a natural philosopher whom you must have seen from time to time at the meetings of the Royal Society. And I doubt if she would choose to leave her African house for so long. She travels with singular ease, quite alone, or with just one or two servants. She means to take the Gaboon next month, the comfortable Portuguese guinea man she sailed in before, which will take her to London, carrying at least some of our letters. There she will stay a few days and then head south in a postchaise.
Purely between ourselves, I may add that she is rather wealthy.
So much the better. Does ease travelling so. Lord Stephen, I'm so pleased with what you tell me. You will take a glass of wine, will you not?
If you please. I should be very happy to drink a glass of wine with you, my dear. But first, Jack, let me say that a government packet is leaving at high tide the day after tomorrow, and if it could carry your letter to Sophie together with one of mine, I should be most singularly obliged. Jack touched the bell, and without much surprise he saw the door instantly fly open, showing an ugly, inquisitive face, vainly attempting to conceal a grin.
"Kill it," he said. "What have we got in the net under the counter?"
3 of Hoxton and half a dozen of champagne.
"Rouse out a couple of champagne, will you, and light along my best writing paper and a fresh ink pot."
"Aye, aye, sir. Champagne it is. Paper best. Which Mr. Hanson is now stripping for his fight with that dogged Polyphemus reefer."
"Should you like to watch, Stephen, just for a round or two?" asked Jack.
"Certainly, and you will tell me about the finer points, but don't let us cause the wine to lose what coolness it may have."
On the forecastle, by a gross abuse of cordage, equipment and stanchions, a tolerable ring had been improvised. Both young men were in their corners, listening to their battered old second's advice. Then, at the bell, they leapt up, towed the imaginary line in the middle, and set about one another with a singular ferocity. This was the lightweight final bout, and each burned to win it for his own ship. For himself, too, but this was less evident. Polyphemus, burly and thick, liked to close and batter ribs, chest, and, if possible, flanks. Young Surprise, more agile, kept his distance, throwing in some very pretty lefts at Polyphemus' bleeding face. But for 3 gasping rounds, he couldn't hit the stolid youth's chin hard enough to throw his head back. Jack's and Stephen's whispered prayers and audible advice had no effect until the 5th round, when Polyphemus, with lowered guard, sought to avoid a shocking blow on his nose, jerked back, head and all, exposed his throat, and received the final disabling, choking blow. Jack congratulated both gasping, exhausted combatants, awarded the minute silver cup, then learnt that Polyphemus had crushed Surprise in the pulling race for cutters round the port, and all hands cheerfully adjourned for the general feast provided by Surprise, at which Harding presided, the captain being taken up with paperwork, seeing that they were now to weigh at the height of flood.